I just started the recording now. Just for the purposes of archives, we're talking about a case where this weight of the uterus of a hysterectomy was not provided. So getting back to that, the way to do it, I'm just going to put us... Okay, so what you put on paper is weight, NA, not available. And when the examiner reads this, he or she's obviously going to say, what do you mean it's not available? Why not? What happened? What's wrong? And so when they see it, and it catches the eye very easily, because you typically expect to see a number there, not letters, you know, so... they probably will see it, and you've got an excellent chance that they're going to ask you what happened. And that's you're in a way, and I say this with all due respect, you're actually baiting the examiner because you want to have this conversation. So when they ask you what happened, how do you follow up verbally now? And for those of you that have been listening over the weeks and months, you'll know what my motto is: be open, be honest, be transparent, be yourself. And so what you say, the total truth. When I got the specimen back, I noticed there was no weight on it, and I constantly phoned the pathologist and expressed, you know, that there's no weight, could they please correct it? And I was informed that they didn't have the specimen any longer. By saying that, you're showing the examiner that even though you don't have it, the concept of having it is important to you. And it's important enough that you went the extra mile to phone up the pathologist and see what was happening. But it doesn't end there. The examiner would be perfectly entitled to follow that up along the following lines and to say to you, okay, I understand that happens, it's happened to me as well, that's fine. But tell me, why is it important to have the weight of a uterine specimen in a pathology report? And that would just be the closing question on this issue. And I would answer something like, you know, I want to make sure that the ultimate size postoperatively roughly matches the clinical or sonographic size. Because if it didn't, if it's hugely over or underestimated, I might take that into account when reading a subsequent ultrasound report from the same sonographer. Or, you know, I might, if this kind of thing happens repeatedly, I would learn that maybe I'm slightly overcalling my clinical estimation of pelvic mass. I would take this all into account. So I think while it doesn't make any difference to the patient per se, it's a post-surgical fact, I think it is beneficial as going forward for me to know what the weight of all my specimens are. So that's how I would handle that question. And as I say, I think this issue probably is relevant for virtually everyone listening in. I hope you found that helpful. Let's move on to the next question. Unlock. Let me see. Maya, are you there? Maya, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Maya, thank you so much for volunteering, for sending in your case. I appreciate it. And welcome. I've got what you sent us via email, but for the sake of everyone listening in, why don't you very briefly present your case to us, and then we can talk about it.
Okay. So this is a 48-year-old G0. She initially came to me for severe heavy menstrual bleeding, and on my exam, I noticed an enlarged fibroid uterus. And so she had had this history for a long time. She had had multiple blood transfusions due to her heavy bleeding. And she had tried a couple of birth control options. They really didn't work out well for her. And so we talked about all of her options, and she opted for definitive surgical management.
Okay, let me interrupt you there for a moment. Mm-hmm. What other conservative options did you consider might be possible for this patient that she declined?
We talked about doing hormonal birth controls. We talked about just birth control pills, Depo-Provera, IUD, Marine IUD. She had tried the birth control pills and Depo-Provera in the past and didn't have undesired side effects with both of them, and it really didn't help out with her bleeding that much. We talked about potentially doing just a myomectomy. Now, she had a lot of fibroids, and she was kind of...
Were you supportive of the notion of a myomectomy? I'm transitioning, folks, for all of you listening in. I'm transitioning into oral exam technique. Maya, I hope you don't mind, but it's really a beautiful case to discuss. So go ahead. Let's see how you handle the question. Were you in support of a myomectomy on a 48-year-old?
It was not an option that I highly recommended for her, because she had such large, from her exam and from the imaging, I could tell that she had such large fibroids and such numerous fibroids that I don't think a myomectomy would have been a successful option for her. I think she would have ended up with having a hysterectomy.
Okay, so the primary reason in a patient like this, I would contend, for doing a myomectomy would be to preserve fertility. Otherwise, just go ahead and do a hysterectomy.
Right.
So then why did you even offer the myomectomy? You see, folks, and Maya especially, what's happening here is I sensed, I'm playing the role of examiner now, I sensed a weakness in her presentation. And so now I'm drilling down on that weakness. And the weakness is you appear to say that you were willing to consider a myomectomy even when you acknowledge that fertility was not an issue here. And that, I would argue, is a you're contradicting yourself in a sense. Does that make sense to you, Maya? Or am I missing something?
No, I mean...
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. We discussed those options.
I thought you had a comment on this issue. I just want to point out for you, Maya, and everyone listening in, understand if you leave a question mark which has potential clinical relevance, the examiner will drill down on that with you. And so you've got to really think about how you're going to present. And this actually speaks to the issue that you really got to practice talking because you folks are not used to it, okay? And you don't want to inadvertently say something which can, this is not a big deal, but you want to shine. You want to be operating on all cylinders the whole time and impress your examiners the whole time. You don't want to say anything that might be construed as having missed a point. So that's point number one. Excuse me. And point number two, this is for 100% of all candidates taking the exam every year. You need to always show how you exhausted conservative therapy. So, and I would have said, Maya, if I was in your situation, I would have said, you know, she failed medical therapy. We tried multiple attempts, birth control pill, progesterone, IUD as well. None of this worked. She asked about a myomectomy. I said it's a possibility, but I counseled against it because fertility was not an issue in this case at age 48. We also discussed whether or not she was a candidate for endometrial ablation, but with the size of the uterus and the shape of the cavity, this was not a feasible option either. We did discuss UAE, uterine artery embolization, but when I discussed the pros and cons and the success rates and the the repeat surgery hysterectomy rates that might be required, she declined that option also. We had also discussed whether or not a DNC might give some temporary relief at the very least. So having discussed all these other options, she really wanted definitive therapy, and so we went on to go on to discussing pros and cons of hysterectomy. How does that sound to you, Maya? Do you understand how I – the point I'm trying to make, folks, is I've shown how I've listed, even though I didn't do them on the patient, I've shown the examiner – I am aware of all the options that we can consider in a situation like this that will potentially avoid major surgery. Even if a myomectomy is not much, but less morbid than a hysterectomy, but you'd only do that if fertility was an issue. So the take-home message, Maya, and for everyone else listening in, show the examiner that you exhausted all conservative options. And Maya, I'm pretty sure you did do that, but you didn't say it in your presentation, and that's the point I want to make, okay? All right.
Okay,
go ahead now. Carry on.
So we proceeded with the total abdominal hysterectomy. I proceeded with that route of hysterectomy given the size of the uterus based on my physical exam. Her hysterectomy was performed without any major complications. We did have some bleeding from the right-sided uterine ovarian ligament during our hysterectomy, so we had to proceed with removal of that right ovary. The other ovary.
Hold on, uterine ovarian or infundibular pelvic. I'm being a little bit specific with you.
I'm sorry.
Are you talking about the infundibular pelvic ligament?
No, she had bleeding.
You first clamped medial to the ovary, and then with the bleeding, you clamped lateral to the ovary. Is that what happened?
Yes.
Okay. All right, fine. I'm with you. Go ahead. Maybe I misspoke. Carry on.
And so she, so we had to remove the right ovary for that reason. So she postoperatively, she went over to our postoperative unit. About 3 to 4 hours after the surgery, she started to have a vital signs that were consistent with. She started to have vital signs where her blood pressure had dropped down to the 100s over 80s or over 70s, and her heart rate had.
Okay, Ma, I'm just going to tell you to speed up your presentation. They're never going to give you this much time, okay, on one case, but go ahead.
So we decided to do a blood transfusion. A couple hours later, she continued to have the sign of her vital signs. At that time, there was a concern for intra-abdominal bleeding, and so we proceeded to take her back to the OR. When we did our exploratory laparotomy, there was bleeding from that right where the right ovary had been removed, and the IP ligament, there was some bleeding from that area, so we had to repair that IP ligament. And afterwards, we examined, there was hemostasis. Because we had to go and repair the right-sided IP ligament, we did a cystoscopy to ensure that the ureters were not affected. They were not. And she then proceeded to her routine postpartum course. She did receive massive transfusion protocol during the process.
Okay. What's your concern with this case? That you had a complication with a repeat visit to the OR. Is that the issue?
Yes.
Okay. So, look, none of us want to have this in practice. It doesn't look good, even though you can be the best surgeon in town. It doesn't look good. But, as I said, you can be the best surgeon in town. It can still happen to you. And so, deal with it. And from the exam point of view, this is actually a fantastic case. I'm going to give you one shot at guessing the answer that I'm going to give you. What do you think is the major discussion going to be I'll give you two major discussions on this case. And all of you at home can think about it yourselves. What do you think are the two major discussion points for a case that you, like you've just heard? Maya, what do you think the two discussion points are?
Probably talking about the anatomy of the ureter.
Absolutely. This is almost a dead certainty for being asked the course of the ureter. So if you've got anything where you're going to, on paper or verbally, mention the infundibular pelvic ligament, excuse me, forget about the fact that you did a cystoscopy and you actually mentioned the ureters. If you've got infundibular pelvic ligament clamping, especially in the scenario of excessive bleeding, be prepared for the course of the ureter. Okay, and the other one is obviously the practical management of this issue. Now, I'm just going to speed up a little bit. You obviously have to know blood component therapy. Now, those of you that have listened before to me, have heard me say, you don't need to know much of anything in detail. An exception to that is blood component therapy. You do need to know it in fair detail. And like I mentioned last time, we know from past history, virtually every one of you are going to come to our definitive board prep course. We're going to discuss this at that course. So you'll get a good feel and get a very nice comfort level as to what you need to know, and you'll learn a lot of it at the course. We've got you covered. But suffice at this point to say that you do need to know blood component therapy in fair detail. The next thing, if they want to, I don't, this is a little demeaning to the examiner, and I don't really mean it that way, but if they want to play with you, just to see how far they can push you, they can ask you the anatomy of the hypogastric artery, okay? And you know, where does the uterine artery come off, or the anterior and posterior divisions of the hypogastric? This is in the iliac arteries. This is fair game. It's fair game for everyone. How much more so if you've got a case like this on your case list? So you've got to know that. And the fact that you had to be reopened, it's tough. You did the right thing. Even when you did the first surgery, you mentioned, at least on paper, I think you mentioned it as well, verbally, that she was drying. All the pedicure, you did the right thing. Despite that, she bled. And as long as you are doing the right thing, and if and when you notice a complication, you react in an appropriate fashion, which is exactly what you did, you've done the right thing. I would argue, based on what you've told us, Maya, that heaven forbid, even if the patient would have died, you would have come out having done the right thing. Because you watched the vitals, and when things didn't happen the way they should have, you acted. You gave a blood transfusion. When that settled and then unsettled, you acted. You went back in again. You did the right thing. That's the key thing. The way I always put it is as follows. They will not ding you for having a complication, but they can ding you for not recognizing it and not treating it appropriately. So the fact that you have this complication, from the exam point of view, I'm thrilled. It makes for a wonderful conversation. So I don't want you to be worried about this case. It's a great case. Obviously, be able to talk about briefly about cystoscopy as well. But it's a great case. They also might ask you about preoperative depo-lupron. But don't worry about the case. It's a great case. So, okay. With that being said, Maya, are you comfortable, or do you still have any other further questions?
No, thank you.
All right, good. I'm pleased that was helpful. Okay. I'm seeing online that, or maybe I'm wrong, There is someone by the name of Melody who signed in, and Melody has also is the one who's offered up two questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to unmute us so that Melody can come in. I'm hoping it's the same Melody. Let's just...
Hi, yes.
Okay, let's
me.
Try this. Is that you, Melody? Thank you so much. Just a message to everyone else, we're all unmuted. So please, can you make sure that there's no background noise? Because otherwise, it really will affect all of us. Okay, Melody, you sent us two cases. Let's try and get through the first one at least, and we'll see about the second. So again, let me have you present the case. I've got it in front of me, but present it for the sake of everyone else listening in.
Sure. So this was a 27-year-old female, G6P2. She presented with pre-viable PPROM at 21 and 5 with reported history of leaking for the past 3 weeks. However, this was the first time presenting for this concern. She had three prior SABs and two-term deliveries. She was admitted due to the pre-prom for management. She was found to be anhydramnios by bedside ultrasound. And after 24 hours of management and care, she developed chorioamnionitis, where she ultimately was...
Sorry, after how long did you say? How long did she, before she got the chorio?
24 hours.
24 hours. Okay, go ahead.
Upon admission, she did sign medical termination paperwork due to concerns after counseling regarding viability of the fetus as well as maternal risk factors. And after the 24-hour mark, she did, in fact, show signs of chorio, where we did proceed with the medical termination of pregnancy. And she was delivered by a colleague that day. Therefore, I did not place any information of the newborn at that time. But, yes, the baby, there was a perinatal death after delivery.
And you're worried because you got a perinatal death on your case list. Is that correct?
Actually, I wanted to speak about the medical termination of pregnancy because I do understand that recently there have been a lot of discussions regarding this hot topic, and just based off of defending a medical termination, I wanted to see what would the best way be of defending that on a case.
So when you say it's a hot topic, are you talking about... from a medical perspective, or are you talking from a social or political perspective?
Well, social, political, however, I understand from a medical perspective, we do understand the necessity of it, but I didn't know from a social, political aspect of defending it appropriately if there would be any...
Okay, all right. So this now, I mean, it's really very straightforward, but let me go through... The salient issues regarding a case like this. Many of you may have a case very similar to this. A few of you are doing terminations of pregnancy upon request, and I'm not here to pass a social political judgment on that. And that's what a fair examiner would do as well. The politics of abortions or terminating pregnancy stays outside the exam room. Okay? You should not fear that will come into play. I will say, I think people will generally agree with me that ACOG, and I'm not passing a judgment, I'm not making a judgment, I'm not passing a comment on my personal beliefs. I can talk for an hour on the subject, you'll never know what my personal beliefs are. But it is my opinion that ACOG, in their publications, over the last couple of years, have become a little more liberal in their thinking, or at least in their publications. But again, this is just it's an observation, and ACOG could well give me a very strong argument why that's not the case. Well, I'm just sharing with you my thoughts. But at the end of the day, the politics of this matter stays out of the exam room. So number one, You don't need to worry about that, Melody. Okay? So what is this a conversation on? And this is a favorite exam topic. It's a conversation on the management of a peri-viable pregnancy at risk, which is pretty much what you got. They may stretch it. They'll give you a patient who's 22 weeks and 6 days and say she's coming with rupture or, you know, she's having contractions. Will you tocalize, et cetera? So they will ask you about this case, and you've got to discuss the management. So you've got to discuss, these are the questions that any of you who have a case like this, you've got to be prepared to speak to the following. Number one, the most important thing is, how do you counsel the patient? Because it's in answering that question that you show the examiner you understand what the issues are that are involved in a case like this. So you've got to be able to talk about risks and benefits of conservative versus aggressive therapy for both mom and baby. And if you're not sure, you for the baby aspect of things, you may want to get in touch with your neonatologist or pediatrician and ask him or her, in their hands, what is probability chances for survival or discharge alive from hospital, because that's important in your counseling. Another thing you've got to be able to talk about is there's not much pediatrics you need to know in for the exam. But that which you do need to know is how to calculate an APGAR score, okay, which all of us do it 100 times a day. But if you've got to give the details of calculating an APGAR score, many of us will be thoroughly embarrassed because we would struggle with it. But just make sure you touch up on that. And also, given the extreme prematurity, you've got to be able to discuss what are the neonatal complications associated with severe prematurity. Okay, NEC, PDA, sepsis, jaundice, I can't think of others, but there are about two or three more that I typically can come up with, but I can't come up with them at the moment. But you've got to be able to list that. But the key thing is how do you counsel on the prognosis? And keep in mind, when you're counseling, if you have to deliver, you're talking about a C-section, and you're talking about probably a classical C-section, which has got implications for subsequent pregnancies. So you've got to bring that into the conversation as well. And the last thing, if you go down the road of doing a C-section in an attempt to save the baby, or no, let me refresh. You've got a patient. She's developed chorioamnionitis. You've decided you've got to deliver. The question is, would you put the baby on a monitor? And the answer is, if you're doing the C-section for maternal indications and you're writing off the baby, then don't put a monitor on it. It's not going to change anything. If you're hoping to deliver vaginally, sorry, I misspoke. If you're trying to get a vaginal delivery out of this, and you're doing it for maternal reasons, you're allowing her to go, don't monitor the baby. Because if the baby develops a D-cell, what are you going to do? You're not going to do a C-section. So that's the question that you've got to be prepared for, that if you're doing it for the sake of the mother, not the baby, don't monitor the baby. That's the point. Okay. So, Melody, I've spoken a lot about this case. I really think you don't need to be concerned about the politics. If it should come up, and I don't believe it will, and this holds for everyone. Keep your personal opinion out of it. You say, look, these are my obligations as an OBGYN. I would do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I would counsel along the following way, A, B, C, D, E. And that's it. If you on personal, social, or religious grounds do not do terminations or abortions, you should be, it should not count against you. You should be totally honest. You say, for personal religious reasons, I don't do terminations of pregnancy. But you can't leave it there, because if you leave it there, they'll accuse you of patient abandonment. You've got to say, but what I do do is I refer these patients to a colleague who would be comfortable to do this. So you've covered both bases. Melody, are you comfortable with that, or do you have any other questions?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. That really helped.
Okay, great. Good. Let's move on. You had a second case, a GYN case. Go ahead, very briefly, go ahead and tell us, present the case to us.
This is a senior case, a 39-year-old G1P1 who presented with desires.
I've got to interrupt you. You said senior residency case, is that correct?
That's correct.
The chances are that I'm correct when I say that you're a fellow or subspecialist in some area, correct?
I'm a Librist, an OB Librist.
Okay, so there you go. Mostly these are subspecialists when you've got senior resident cases. And about 15-18% of you listening in are fellows. I will just, by the way, at the course, I'll give a presentation. It takes about 20-25 minutes. Just to you folks, because there are a couple of things that are a little different for subspecialists taking the general board exam. Not major issues, but you've got to have just an understanding that there are a few subtle things that pertain differently to you, some for good, some not for good. But we'll discuss that at that time. But I just want you to be aware, as a sub-fellow, a sub-specialty fellow, you either your case list or if in your speech, you give yourself away. Don't think that the examiner won't know. That's the point I wanted to make. Melody, carry on. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No problem. This patient has had a long-standing history of abnormal pap smears. The most recent prior to her hysterectomy was HSIL, the follow-up of a CIN3 on LEAP with a normal endo keratage. She underwent a total abdominal hysterectomy. The uterus weighed 74 grams. The reason why I brought up this case was for two reasons. One, it was that she underwent a PAH for a 74-gram uterus. And also, she did not have a bilateral self-injectomy at the time of her hysterectomy. I understand that I'm able to defend myself saying in my practice, I would perform a bilateral self-injectomy, consider alternative options for a 74-gram uterus. However, being that it's a senior resident case, I wanted to prepare myself on how to defend these two particular...
Okay. There are a couple of issues here that are really wonderful for you and for everyone listening in. Number one, your initial concern is totally appropriate. The default position on every hysterectomy, as far as the exam is concerned, is in fact, as far as practice is concerned, is that all hysterectomies are TVHs unless contraindicated. And then you've got to be able to discuss what those contraindications are. When you would do TVH, when would you do LAVH, when would you do robotic assistance, when would you do TAH? And again, we're going to spend 20-30 minutes on this one issue because it's relevant for everyone. We'll discuss this at our definitive board prep course later on in the year. We've got you covered. At this point, at least suffice to know, it's important you need to know that. So that's point number one. Point number two, your concern is correct. Why didn't you do a BS? And this brings up to the third point, and that is, you did this as a senior resident. And here again, I'm going to tell you, be totally open and honest. Be transparent. You got to be honest. Who was the one making decisions on this case? It wasn't you. It was your attending. So how can you be held responsible for what your attending decides, especially as a resident? So the way to handle this in the exam is, number one, I would actually emphasize TAH. I would put in parenthesis not TVH with an exclamation mark. I want the examiner to see it. I want them to ask me, well, why didn't you do a TVH? And then you get involved in this conversation that we're now having. So I would encourage you to emphasize it rather than try and hide it, okay? And if and when this topic comes up, you say openly and honestly, you say, you know, this patient was managed during my senior year of residency, and my attending, for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect, elected to do this as a TAH. I think I would have preferred, in principle at least, to have done this as a TVH, at the very least a laparoscopic case. This was a small uterus. She was a para 1. You could say she had a big baby. This did not, in my opinion, necessarily require an abdominal incision. And that leads into a discussion on the pros and cons of each route of hysterectomy. But you say, given the fact that I was the resident, I bowed to, and you use this language if you want, I bowed to my attending senior authority and knowledge and went ahead and did this as a TAH. If I were to manage this case today, making the decision myself, I would do ABC. So what you need to do is you need to be open and honest, say why it was done as a TAH, say why you disagree with your attending. Notice what's very important. You don't throw your attending under the bus. I did it in a very professional way. I said, I've got the utmost respect for my attending, but in this case, I would have done it differently. And you're being very respectful. So I encourage you to do that. And then explain the pros and cons of your approach versus your attending's approach. And that's it. Just by the way, I've given you a general answer for when your management, and this is for everyone listening in, when your management would disagree with the management that you've got on your case list during a senior residency case, or perhaps you called in a subspecialist, a gyn-onc, and they may have done something which you probably wouldn't have done. And I'm not talking about lymph node biopsies. They might have done a simple hist instead of a radical hist or whatever. They've got license to do things a little differently because they have much more experience in that area. So you bow to their superior knowledge in this area. But you need to be comfortable to say that. There's one additional point that I want to mention, which is specific to this particular case. And I'm guessing about 25% of you may have a case similar on your case list. If the patient has had a prior LEAP or especially a cone, it's quite conceivable also, if she's a menopausal woman, it's quite conceivable that there's either minimal or no real cervix left to identify, which makes dissecting into the uterovesical space and the uterorectal space very difficult. And that may be a reason why you want to avoid the vaginal approach. And then you've got to discuss what are the pros and cons of a laparoscopic approach versus an abdominal approach. But be prepared for the question if you've got a case specifically like this. So, Melody, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Do you mind touching up real quick on not performing the bilateral salpingectomy? Would that be defended in the same manner?
It's the same principle. I would add the following. I would say I would not have done this as a TAH. And by the way, you'll notice there wasn't a bilateral salpingectomy. I think this should have been done. I cannot recall why it wasn't done, or I can recall, and my attending said X, Y, or Z. But if I were the one to be making the call, a patient such as this would get a bilateral salpingectomy at the same time.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so
much. Sound reasonable to you? Okay,
absolutely.
Sure. All right, good. So folks, we're done. Just a couple of comments before we sign off. Firstly, Melody, did you find it helpful, the session? I say this because I'm hoping you did. I'm pretty sure that you did, but I'm hoping you need to be honest, because I want everyone listening in, I want to encourage people to volunteer. It's really good experience and exposure. So please be honest. Tell us, how did you feel about this experience?
Oh, very helpful. It's my second time presenting a case to one of these seminars, and I always find it helpful. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Maya, if you're still there, how about you?
I found it really helpful. Thank you.
All right, good. Look, folks, I this is a free service. I want you to make the most of it. So please don't be shy. You'll notice I didn't mention either Maya or Melody's last name, because I don't even have it. I don't even know their last name. Okay? But please, don't be worried about, you know, answering a question incorrectly, because I never mentioned the last name. It's impossible. So don't worry about that. Encourage your friends to, A, come and join us on the teleseminar, and then also to volunteer as an active participant. All right, folks, with that being said and done, the next teleseminar will be on the 21st of May. I want to just get a plug very, very quickly to you folks. If you haven't yet attended our caseless construction course, I strongly, strongly, strongly urge you to do so. It's available online at a time of your choosing. It's about, I want to say it's a 7, maybe 8-hour long course. You can do it on a Sunday, whole day, or perhaps 2 evenings, but it'll make a huge difference to the way you look at, and more importantly, the way you construct your cases. I encourage you to do this if you haven't already joined. Okay, folks, that's it. Thank you to Melody. Thank you to Maya. And we'll see you again all on the 21st of May. That's in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, folks. This then concludes our teleconference. Take care. Bye-bye.